This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
You're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast, best bits from Friday, September the 16th. Roger Federer has announced his retirement. Yep, I know we knew it was all coming, but still came as something of a shock, an opportunity for us to look back at the extraordinary career, not just on the court, but also off the court of the great Fed Express. Squire Patton Boggs Dubai office is, of course, where you find Steve Bainbridge, a sports lawyer of some repute. We got in touch with Steve to ask about the legacy that Roger Federer will leave behind in the game of tennis. Talking of legacies, they don't get much bigger than the reign of Her Majesty the late Queen Elizabeth II, currently lying in state in Westminster Hall ahead of her funeral on Monday next week. We spoke to the UA ambassador to the United Kingdom, Mansour Abul-Hul, about the impact that the late Queen Elizabeth II had, not just on her reign over British citizens, but also relationships around the world, none more so than that very close relationship with the UAE. Adnan Kazim is the CCO of Emirates Airline. He was part of that trip to the United States, which Brandy Scott found herself on. Brandy took the opportunity to catch up with Adnan to talk about where we're at with the airline as a whole. When will we get back to those all-important PP figures, the pre-pandemic figures for the airline? And as you'll hear, Adnan very positive despite a couple of risks on the horizon. Plenty of chat on a Friday show. As always, we talked about those new Dubai tourism numbers showing that people are travelling to Dubai in good numbers. We spoke about the travel impact that is having into and out of the country. And we also got the thoughts from Ed Bell of Emirates NBD on those latest travel numbers.
So let's jump into one of our top stories this morning. Travel making business headlines today here in the UAE for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Tom, we've got those numbers from Dubai Tourism, haven't we, about visitors in the first seven months of this year, 8.1 million. We're back to more than a million punters a month, aren't we?
We are indeed. Good numbers coming out from the Dubai Tourism, Dubai Economy and Tourism Department. So Dubai Media Office announcing these yesterday. The numbers are 8.1 million international visitors in the first 7 months of this year. Threefold increase on year, surpassing the total of 21. Tourism sector certainly recovering. It has recovered, up for debate at the moment, hosting 7.28 million visitors in 21. So coming close to eclipsing the total at the end of June when it welcomed 7.12 million visitors in the first half of 2022. They're all good numbers. I mean, I can throw numbers all day long if you like, but it does show that, you can't argue with the figures there. People are, if you build it, they will come, and they are coming at the moment, and they're spending.
They are indeed. Let's get an economic take on this. Ed Bell is Senior Director of Market Economics. He's been looking at those tourism statistics for Dubai.
We've had some very strong numbers for Dubai's tourism industry in the first 7 months of the year. Total visitors hit 8.1 million between January and July. That's a 184% increase on the numbers that we saw from 2021. The biggest kind of market that we saw contributing to that growth was India, but there was also very large regional growth. So Oman, Saudi Arabia, also in the top five of visitors. And then kind of your traditional source markets for Dubai tourism, like UK and Russia, rounding out the rest of the top five. Now, while the numbers are quite strong, they do represent still some ways to go on pre-pandemic levels. So we're about 15% below the kind of levels we saw in 2019. Now, while the industry has had a strong start to the year, there are some relative headwinds ahead, given that the US dollar is quite strong, making Dubai a relatively more expensive destination for tourists. With that in mind, however, we do have the benefit of the big World Cup event happening later this year, where Dubai could be well positioned to benefit from some spillover tourism effects.
That is the economist's take, Ed Bell from Emirates NBD. Now let's get the airline executive's take. Adnan Kazim is the Chief Commercial Officer of Emirates Airline. He's been speaking with Brandy Scott on her trip to Washington, D.C. in the United States. They were mainly talking about the tie-up with United, but they had a wider conversation as well. And she asked them, when are they going to get back to what we're calling PP, pre-pandemic?
As far as Emirates is concerned, we're ramping up. We're going towards the 80 gradually when the peak will commence, hopefully sometime in December. The aim for us to go back to pre-pandemic level by next year. That's our goal.
But early, again, mid?
I would not say early. It will be half of next year onward. But again, there are so many things linked to readiness of many airports in mainly Asia. China, we don't know where that would stand. So it's a lot of these external factors that will play the role in terms of how we can bring things back to normal. But from the company perspective, we're putting everything ready to go back to where we lifted earlier.
Adnan Kazim of Emirates Airline. Now, we're talking about the economics of tennis.
Two games on.
And that is because one of the greatest players of all time and Dubai resident Roger Federer has retired or announced his retirement. He's got one more game, as Nadia said, to play next week. This is him speaking on Instagram overnight.
This is a bittersweet decision because I will miss everything the tour has given me. But at the same time, there is so much to celebrate. I consider myself one of the most fortunate people on earth. I was given a special talent to play tennis, and I did it at a level that I never imagined for much longer than I ever thought possible.
I mean, he's Swiss, Tom, isn't he? But he spent a big part of the last 20 years in Dubai with his family.
Yeah, I mean, he has property here. We know that he does a lot of warm winter training here, not a million miles away from where we broadcast, in fact, a few of the courts that he has. I'll tell you what, so what was it? I nearly sort of choked on my cornflakes a couple of years ago when I went up to hit a few balls up our tennis court, just like our community tennis courts up where we are. And Roger Federer was there, hitting a few balls. Yeah, yeah. The courts were closed, it has to be said, for the day. But there he was, just having a little train. I think it was they were resurfacing the courts elsewhere that he usually used or something like that. And so therefore, he'd taken himself up there with the person who was looking after him at the time. So it's he's well. He knows this part of the world very well. He knows Dubai very well. As I said, trains here, has a property here, always speaks very fondly of his time here as well. And here's hoping now he doesn't have to travel the world, maybe spend a bit more time here as well.
Well, this is one tennis coach that I know he's worked with. Clark Francis has been synonymous with tennis in Dubai for several decades now and knows Roger Federer well. I spoke with Clark last night and this is what he had to say about Roger Federer and his relationship with Dubai.
He will, of course, retire as one of the true legends of the sport of tennis, but he will undoubtedly be remembered for his grace, his poise and his elegance around the court. Of course, we all know about his 20 slams, his Olympic gold medal and his record 310 weeks as world number one. But I always thought that one of his almost unbelievable stats was that he reached 23 straight Grand Slam semi-finals. After 31 years of ATP at Dubai Duty Free Tennis Stadium, my biggest personal regret will be that we will never again experience what we fondly called a Federer night.
And he could empty the Irish village and fill the stadium, couldn't he, Tom? Absolutely. You weren't gonna miss that. Absolute box office.
And he left his mark on that tournament. That's for sure.
He won his 100th tournament there, did he not? When he hit 100 a couple of years ago.
I think you're right. Yeah, yeah, exactly that. He's made many records there. So he's left his mark there. And as you said, Clark, who worked closely with him, Gwen Sproul, who worked closely with him and still works closely with him here in the region. He's been a great sort of advocate of the region.
So he's got many connections with Dubai. He's been playing tennis here. He's done a lot of sponsorship work here as well with Brand Dubai. I have never met the guy. You've met him several times, Tom. I haven't met him, but I was with him just before the pandemic when the biggest Rolex store in the world opened in Dubai.
Okay.
With Ahmed Siddiqui, and he is a Rolex ambassador, whatever it may be. He has been for some time, and he was there. And it's a big old shop. But he just, his presence and his aura was just incredible and immense. And of course, he was like suited and booted then. There was no tennis whites. But he did have that aura. But all of these things pale into insignificance compared to Roger Federer's biggest impact on Dubai? You know where I'm going with this one, don't you, Tom?
I don't think we're...
Which is Roger Federer making an advert about 15, 20 years ago for a Swiss insurance company filmed here in Dubai. Nadia Swan's with us in the studio. Nadia, good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
Have you seen the advert?
I have indeed, you very much so.
So if you watch it on TV, we're going to play it now. Nadia's going to push the button and we'll play it. But just it's available on our Instagram page. So you can watch it there as well. But Tom Urquhart's in it, aren't you, Tom? So can you paint a picture of the insurance ad in your own words?
National Swiss Insurance or some other company. We did a TV commercial, I think it was 2008 when we did this. It was filmed here. Roger was obviously very much the peak of his career at the moment. I wasn't, as my haircut attests to during the advert.
It basically shows the skills. I think it was 20 years ago. Because you were a young, floppy haired. You look great, but it's a while ago, wasn't it?
It was a while ago, yes. It was a long time ago, but a very, very fun day. And again, just a sort of indication of what a gentleman he is. You know, there was no us and them or anything like that. Just sat with Mr. Federer discussing life and times, and we've discussed ever since, really.
So the shtick is, he turns up at a house in Dubai and rings the doorbell, and Tom answers the door, and a cat is on the balcony above, knocks a plant pot off, and Federer shows his skills by catching it behind himself.
Yes.
So that's what's happening in this video. But Nadia, you're going to push the button now, aren't you?
Now?
If you watch it on TV, it's brilliant. But if you're listening in your car, it's also brilliant.
Okay. Yeah, there we go.
Einer der perfektesten Schweizer. Mit Sicherheit. Für alle anderen gibt es National Swiss. National Swiss, die Kunst des Versicherns.
Roger Federer and Tom Urquhart.
15 years ago.
Producer Shruti says it was 2007.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Talking aviation now, Brandy Scott is currently on a plane on the way back from Washington, D.C., probably horizontal in a very comfortable seat. She has been joking about, she's been working hard. She's been covering the Emirates tie-up with United Airlines. Now, we heard her interview with Sir Tim Clark yesterday, the CEO of Emirates. But while she was there, she bumped into the chief commercial officer at Emirates Airline, Adnan Kazim, and she took the opportunity to talk to him about everything from Chinese lockdowns to pilot wages. But she began with a big football event happening in a few weeks' time, the World Cup in Qatar, asking how much of a passenger bump that could be for Emirates. This is Adnan Kazim.
As we know, the World Cup timelines or time frame is going to be during the end of November, mid-November till mid of December. This falling during the peak time. Anyway, I think that the December is flights are quite full. Many people are traveling. Hoteliers in Dubai during that period, if I look at it from last year, they were operating at 90% occupancy in month of November. This year will not be any different. Booking are quite strongly, I think, coming to Dubai for winter season of Dubai. Definitely, I think the World Cup is added value. Many people may end up into Dubai with fan zones, watch the matches in Dubai, not necessarily they'll end up into Doha. But even with that, with a shuttle happening between DWC and Doha with Fly Dubai, you see many people traveling up and down between the two points as well.
Is Emirates and its staff ready for enthusiastic, party-minded football fans?
Dubai was always fully equipped to handle such events in the past. I mean, if I look at it from a major event that Dubai have just completed, the Expo 2020, it's a testimony how Dubai can manage such big gathering and crowd without even meeting millions of people. with different different sort of characters, different cultures, and the mix. Dubai anyway today handle over 200 nationalities. I don't think that's something unique, and that's how Emirates even. I mean, today the Emirates culture is sitting around 200 nationalities. So to bring in the people from all over the world with all the fun and all the joy that will come along with it, this is not unique for us. This is part of the Dubai culture, Dubai way of handling such events.
So you're at 75% of pre-pandemic numbers at the moment, as I understand it, out of summer. When do you think we'll get back to 100%?
Well, I think as far as Emirates is concerned, we're ramping up. I mean, we're going towards the 80 gradually when the peak will commence, hopefully sometime in December. The aim for us to go back to pre-pandemic level by next year. That's our goal.
But early, again, mid?
I would not say early. It will be half of next year onward. But again, there are so many things linked to readiness of many airports in mainly Asia. China, we don't know where that would stand. So it's a lot of these external factors that will play the role in terms of how we can bring things back to normal. But from the company perspective, we're putting everything ready to go back to where we left it earlier.
And you're on a massive recruitment drive at the moment. How many people do you need in terms of pilots and crew? What are you looking for?
Well, still we have many aircraft sitting on the ground, many 380s. The ramp up of the crew is happening at as planned. Same thing with the pilots. As I said, this ramp up will go over phases. We're adding 5 points every 2-3 months to get into that level of the 100% sometime half of next year. So that ramp up is something like every day is happening, and recruitment campaigns, as you have seen, is all over the world, attracting different nationalities. It's happening. I mean, people would like to be part of Emirates' growth. They like to be part of Dubai. So yes, it's quite, we're getting the number required as we progress.
And yet all the headlines around the world are about inflation and rising cost of living and the war for talent. Are you having to pay more to get the right people?
We, as an airline, we're quite an close to our employee in terms of, and this is part of, again, the business model of Emirates. Many times we have even, we try to study many of these markets that we operate. We try to match to the requirement of the inflation, the cost of living, all these things cut part of the factor that when we adjust our salaries for our employees, and where we operate today to over 150 destinations, we look at even from the regulation, the policies, the benchmarking that happens with many airlines in terms of what they pay. We try to position ourselves for sure in a quite a decent level that satisfy our employee. We give them all the tools and all what they require in terms of the coverages. So we haven't seen, we're running short of employee. Not to be attracted to this company. The number is quite big. We have thousands of application whom people whom they want to be part of this success story in terms of the company, and that's something is part of the DNA of the company. We're quite fair airline in how we handle with our employee and handle them quite well.
Before I let you go, two things globally, and you mentioned one of them, that are impacting aviation, one being the continued lockdowns in China and the other obviously being the war in Ukraine. Are you seeing an impact on Emirates operations and the numbers of people on planes because of those?
Not really. I mean, for us, the war which is going on between, this is more politically, I think, need to be handled, but from demand from the East Europe or from Europe or even from places that we operate, we haven't seen any dip in terms of the booking. We had quite a healthy summer that we have gone through. There are so many factors, including the inflation, the currency devaluations happening in many places. We're managing everything as part of the external challenges that you need to maneuver and try to address. Today, still we're seeing a healthy demand coming in. People are still wanting to travel. Gradually they're opening up now. I mean, from where we lifted earlier, Guangzhou, now we have permission to add two more flights. So we're moving from 1 weekly flight to 3 weekly flight. We're hoping even that we get gradually access to Shanghai and Beijing, which we're operating. It may take some time, but for sure, one day they will come back.
That's the voice of Adnan Kazim. He's the chief commercial officer at Emirates Airlines, speaking to Brandy Scott in Washington, D.C. Brandy is on her way back, and she'll be back in the studio on Monday morning.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
So, as we have been reporting, Her Majesty, the late Queen's coffin, is currently lying in state ahead of her state funeral on Monday, 2 o'clock. Local time here in the UAE on Monday afternoon, 11 a.m. over in London. In fact, a number of schools sending out directives yesterday to parents about plans that they're putting in place with regards to a number of parents expressing their desire/demands for children to watch the funeral as well. Did you get one of those letters? If so, do let us know. You can text us on 4001. In the meantime, though, our producer, Mohammed Suleiman, has been speaking to the UAE's ambassador to the United Kingdom, His Excellency Mansour Abulhul. He began by sharing his thoughts and emotions on the Queen's passing.
Obviously, great emotion, and I think it's one that we've seen the British nation, but also the Emirati nation, sharing in grief with the loss of Her Majesty. A very cherished and loved figure. From my perspective, I think a lot of people had personal sort of experience of meeting Her Majesty. And a family sort of story that we cherished really is my eldest sister, Hamda, presented Her Majesty with a bouquet of flowers during her first state visit to the UAE in 1979. 40 years on, there's myself, the privilege of my life, going into Buckingham Palace with my wife, Victoria, and presenting Her Majesty with my credentials as the ambassador to Court of St. James, representing the United Arab Emirates. So I think, you know, from that perspective, you know, great privilege. So she touched us sort of personally as a family. And I think Her Majesty had this amazing ability to do that in many people's lives.
The ambassador, Mansour Abulhul, going on to describe the legacy and the deep friendship of the Queen and the UAE.
Such a powerful legacy. You know, Her Majesty did so much work, you know, and embodied a great figure in people's minds and lives, people who are young, up to all ages, really. Her legacy is, you know, I think you could write endless books about this, but she's such a powerful legacy, and one that I think she had this great ability to connect with people's lives, to take interest in people's lives. And you know, I think it's the people depth that she had, really, that I think will be her most powerful legacy.
Yeah, talking of connections, he also says that the Queen had a very special connection with the UAE's leadership.
Incredibly warm, and I always reference that 1979 state visit to the UAE, which was so significant. And one of the great communities within the UAE today is over 100,000 British citizens. But she must, you know, in my mind, must have played a significant sort of catalyst role in terms of forming those friendships between Emiratis and British people and other expatriates, matter of fact. But in terms of leadership, it was a deep friendship, and that was kindled between the late His Highness Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan, who was the founder of the UAE. And you can see from that early footage of her state visit how close it was. Some amazing, amazing sort of events and venues that His Highness took Her Majesty to. And one of the ones that sort of stands out in my mind is this wonderful camel race, this old-fashioned style across the open desert. And the late Duke of Edinburgh was in the car with Her Majesty, a stretched limousine, and I believe His Highness was as well. And just enjoying, you know, sport, heritage, and connecting as friends and people. And I think that has sort of carried through into the very robust and strong bilateral relationship we have, because I, of course, represent work for the government of the UAE, representing them here in the UK. And the royal friendships, the royal bonds we had served almost as a canopy over this under which this bilateral relationship now sits today, and it is vital.
And to that end and role, Mansour was kind enough to describe the importance, the ongoing importance, current state of trade and business relations between the UAE and UK.
Tremendous ties, and it's an extraordinarily strong relationship, but the ambition from both sides, from our leadership, to really take this to new heights. And we saw the announcement of the Partnership for the Future, which is a big initiative, a big far-reaching agreement, to bring together shared values, shared global values, but also strong prosperity pillars. We'll be hosting, the UAE will be hosting COP28 next year. You know, there's been a strong collaboration around climate action between the two countries, but we're seeing very strong inward investment into the UK. But also, we're very pleased and delighted to have over 5,000 companies, based in the UAE, 5,000 strong. And today, we're looking at figures of 5 billion investment from the UAE into key sectors here, energy transition, infrastructure, and so these are really vital areas. And so it's a very deep strategic relationship, but ultimately one that's shared between people and the cultural links, and taking all the way back to my leadership and His Highness Sheikh Hamad bin Zayed, and the links with the new king, King Charles III, His Majesty. It's vital that oversits everything else, because that's really, in essence, what makes everything work.
Those the thoughts there of the current UAE ambassador to the United Kingdom, Mansour Abulhul, giving his thoughts on the Her Majesty, the late Queen, who will be laid to rest on Monday.
I loved his story when he started out talking about his elder sister handing a bouquet to Queen Elizabeth back in the 1970s.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is extraordinary. It's come full circle for Mansour as he sits in that very, very nice embassy. I'm trying to remember where the UAE embassy is in London. I'll find out.
I had to go there '98 when I first moved here, because you had to get your degree certificate attested. Do you remember that?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's Grosvenor Crescent, isn't it?
It's somewhere posh.
It's well posh.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Looking back at the career of Roger Federer now, who announced his retirement overnight. Messages coming in. What message came in, Tom, saying, why are we looking back at the career of Roger Federer and not, for example, Serena Williams? Well, he lives here. She doesn't. So that makes him a local story. This is Federer speaking overnight.
I am 41 years old. I've played more than 1,500 matches over 24 years. Tennis has treated me more generously than I ever would have dreamt. And now I must recognize when it is time to end my competitive career.
The numbers are eye-watering. 20 Grand Slam titles, 31 final appearances, 23 consecutive appearances in Grand Slam semi-finals from 2004 to 2010, 8 Wimbledon titles, 369 match wins in Grand Slams, 310 weeks spent at world number one. I could go on, and I will go on. 2 Olympic gold medals, gold in doubles with Stan Wawrinka in 2008, silver in singles in 2012, and a career prize purse of £113.5 million. In fact, let's talk about Roger Federer in more details. Throughout it all, has been number one for fans, but also for sponsors. He sits alongside Lionel Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo, LeBron James and Tom Brady in a list of the world's richest sports people. He not only excelled in the world of sport, he's also transcended it to give us their thoughts on how he's done exactly that. An absolute pleasure now to be joined live on the line by the partner and head of sports and events Middle East at Squire Patton Boggs Dubai office, Steve Bainbridge. Steve, thanks very much indeed for joining us this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you too, Tom.
Fair to say that he transcended the sport?
Yes, you know, look, I think about that, and as you were, you know, drilling us with the numbers which speak for themselves, I think that's absolutely right. And also pertinent to Richard's point, you know, the question, why are we discussing him? And I think it is partly that issue about him transcending merely the world of sport. We come from an age where there are many athletes who are examples of excess. They remind us that perhaps athletes should not be role models. Roger was something of a throwback in that sense, that He exuded class throughout his career. He always had time for journalists. He was considered. Community involvement was there. And for an athlete who was so dominant based on those numbers that you mentioned, he even had us feeling at times, and certainly towards the end when injuries set in, that he was in fact the underdog.
Let's talk numbers if we can. And we will, of course, in the next couple of days talk about Gio, AT, GOAT, Rafa Nadal, Novak Djokovic, 22, 21, 20. You know, that's going to be the argument ad infinitum. But there is one argument that Federer beats them all on, Steve, as they're not, and that is earnings. He's a $1 billion player, the first tennis player to earn that sort of money, $130.6 million on the court, $870 million off it. I mean, has he, not only has he rewritten the record books, has he set a sort of new standard for players to aspire to?
I think in a sense he has, and this is where it comes to this point about transcending, in the sense that, you know, there are some athletes that manage to hit the heights of the sponsorship world because of the sports they're in and the breadth of appeal that the dynamic fits. But when you look at Roger and you think that this is tennis, tennis is very important, it's always been important, but it's not football, for example, and you have to dig a little bit below those numbers to discern what's going on, and I think it is that character issue. And the fact that he's been a darling of sponsors because of his even temperament, because of the fact that he's been very purposeful in his engagements with the media and that broader piece. So in many senses, you know, and he represents a manner of getting that character behind sports out in front. And I think we may also see, I think it's fair to say, and this will be something we'll only know over the fullness of time, but I think that he may be one of those few athletes that tends to hold their sponsorship value for some years after they finish their playing days.
The thoughts of Angeline Close Scheinbaum, a sports marketing professor at Clemson University, speaking overnight, saying that he is a sports marketer's dream. Angeline saying the reason why ticks all the boxes: trustworthiness, expertise, credibility and attractiveness. That's surely why over a dozen brands have affiliated themselves with him. And is there a time, Steve, I've been scratching my head, you know, all other players, there's at some point they come into some sort of contest with their sponsors and sponsors to say we've got to part our ways. That's never happened with Roger.
Absolutely right. And, you know, and I come from a background, obviously, drafting a lot of these contracts, and we're often worried about break clauses and morality clauses and, you know, what happens when things blow up or there's an issue either on or off the court that makes them, if not toxic, at least something that the sponsor should be looking at getting past. You're right. This simply hasn't happened with Roger. And as I say, he's perhaps a throwback to that era when, you know, you would have thought that athletes are someone that children could look up to, the amount of time and dedication they've put into their sport. He's also been something, it's amazing we're even discussing it with these numbers that you've mentioned and his impact on the court, but he's something of an everyman. So he's not had the one tool, the booming serve. He's been something of a technician. You know, at one point he decided even to change the size of his racket head to increase power at the loss of some control. There's always been a sense when he's faced, and I think too we should note that he's been fortunate in the sense that he's been at a time when there have been these great rivalries. So you mentioned Novak and Rafa, of course, they'll always be the big three. The fact that he's been in a golden era, that his game has had a measure of beauty and purity to it, but also that he's had to work at it and adapt over the years. The age issue now, you know, he's certainly been the most successful at the latter stages of his career in terms of over 30 and even at 35 winning Grand Slams. This is something that has a much broader appeal, and I think that's at the root of the sponsorship value.
And just finally as well, got about a minute left with you, Steve, in terms of, it's interesting because he's obviously a very bright individual as well. We know he's a multiple linguist, etc. But business acumen, because, you know, he was managed by IMG up until 2012. It wasn't a divisive break. He just broke away. It was very amicable at the end of it. But he's actually gone on to see his earnings soar since that break, which must give an insight into his business acumen.
I think that's right. And you know, it's probably no coincidence that that's towards the end of his career when he has the benefit of what he's learned going along. And yeah, I hope that we can see that. He's made statements about continuing in the game in some form or another, whether that's on the commentary side or otherwise. But I think as well, you know, there would be a great grounds to suggest he would be a perfect fit to move into the agency space as well.
Steve, thank you so much indeed for your thoughts this morning. Have a great weekend. Stephen Bainbridge is the partner and head of sports and events Middle East at Squire Patton Boggs Dubai office. Our thanks to him for joining us, talking all things the Fed.
Yeah, and he's around the corner from here. He's La Rev Tower, isn't he, in the marina?
Yeah, number three. Oh, no, I think you can probably figure out which one he's in, actually.
Yeah, one of the bigger ones.
With a billion to his name.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.